Okay, this is Kenneth Baker talking to you on Thursday, October the 22nd, 2009. And I'm being interviewed in front of a bookcase with lots of history books in it.
I'll come in with the first question, I think.
Okay, right.
Why do you think you enjoyed history so much when you were at school?
Well, I was at school during the Second World War, and I was subject to wonderfully old-fashioned Victorian education. The school was a George Mingle primary school, and it didn't have a playing field, it had a yard, and we were taught in a very old-fashioned and very effective way. And history was told to us as a series of stories. And it was fascinating. And it's probably more acute in a time of war, because you're aware of soldiers. I was aware of soldiers coming back to Southport to the infirmaries, and I was aware of open church services in Southport during the war, with soldiers in the actual congregation, and all singing "Onward, Christian Soldiers" every verse. And so it was brought home to one. And then one, I was also aware of the bombing, and I was aware of Churchill's speeches. And so all that was a living history, if you like. My parents gave me very early on our island story, and on our empire story, and Scotland story. And there's a wonderful old books, which have now all been reprinted, again telling the story as a story. And I think that's what fascinated me.
I understand from your memoirs that you differed from Margaret Thatcher in your conception of the national curriculum, since she only wanted a core curriculum. Why did you think it was important to specify 10 subjects?
I wanted to give all pupils and students the chance of a rounded education. It's very important to focus upon English, maths and science. Yes, I accepted that. That was Margaret's preoccupation, as it were. But I wanted to lift the sights a bit higher and ensure that everybody had a chance of learning about other things. And so we settled on a core curriculum and a wider curriculum. And in fact, it was very prescriptive. I'm often accused of being far too prescriptive. But if you establish a national curriculum for the first time in your history, you have to be prescriptive, certainly initially. And the idea of having a national curriculum was that in many schools, the curriculum was quite good. If it was a good school, it had a good curriculum. If it was a mediocre school, it had a mediocre curriculum. If it was a poor school, it had a poor curriculum. It was as simple as that. And there was great inconsistency across the country. And when children moved from one part of the country, say from Northumberland to Devon, they didn't slot in easily at all into the pattern of education. They were studying different things. And some schools have become very idle indeed, and history seemed to consist of doing the dinosaurs three times. And I wanted a bit more than that. And so the national curriculum initially was a comprehensive curriculum and a wide curriculum. And it included history up to the age of 16 and languages up to the age of 16. It was a demanding curriculum. And I think one of the regrets I have, one of the things that I did not do and I failed to do, was to extend the teaching day by at least one period. If I'd been able to do that, I think it would be much easier for schools to absorb the national curriculum in its fullness. But I wasn't able to do that, because back in 1986 I'd settled a teacher's strike which had been going on for 18 months. And part of that settlement was the number of hours that a teacher had to provide a year in teaching. And to reopen that discussion would have opened up a Pandora's box, to say the least.
When you were looking at the national curriculum, did you use continental comparisons in order to get your ideas?
Well, only to some extent, because the various curriculums that existed, to begin with, America doesn't have any sort of national curriculum at all, and I remember talking to the Education Secretary, Bill Bent. He was opining the fact that you could not possibly introduce a national curriculum. It was all done at state levels, and they varied enormously. When it came to Europe, there were various curriculums, and I remember meeting the French minister, Chevenement, who was not a Jacobite, a Jacobean. He was sort of extreme left. And I talked to him about the national curriculum. He said, "Oh, I go home at weekend and write it." And I was absolutely amazed. There was this sufficient flexibility in the French system. But certainly we did look at European systems, and we saw there were forms of curriculum right through in different types of schools, and we took all that into account.
You were talking about how it was guaranteeing a broad and balanced curriculum for every child. Was there any consideration that for some children that might not be suitable?
Well, we tried to make it possible for all children to experience part of it. That was the important thing. I think now the curriculum has to be developed further, and I have now become convinced that the best age of transfer is not 11 but 14. This is quite controversial in the educational world, because by 14 many youngsters have decided really what their interests are and what they would like to study. And I am now championing the creation of 14 to 18 year old technical schools, where youngsters can, under the same roof, do some of the core subjects, English, Maths, Science and IT, alongside their specialism, whether it be engineering or whether it be the construction trades or whether it be environmental services.
They would finish history then at 14?
Well, no, I hope that that will not be the case, and I'll tell you why. Because up to 14, from 14 to 16, they will still have to abide by the essential elements of the core curriculum. They'll also have to have 5 hours of general culture. And what I would like to devise now is for example, those who've taken up engineering, I think I would like to devise courses in great engineers and great inventors of the past, so that leads them in. Why is history important to an engineer? It's important to an engineer to know what has happened in the past, how the metals have changed, how the methods have changed, how the methods of construction have changed, what is likely to happen again in the future. And I think that's one way of engaging their attention. If you make history relevant to people, they become interested.
Did you think at the time of the national curriculum that history was going to be a problematic subject to devise a curriculum for?
I knew from the beginning that history was going to be a problematic subject and difficult, because this is an area where feudal armies march one against the other and people have different views of history. And what was very prevalent at the time when we were fashioning it back in the 1980s was social history. Now, social is a very important part of history. But I went into some classes and I found students of the age of 13 or 14 being asked to imagine themselves in a medieval village where the plague had broken out or something like that, and what was happening and all the rest of it. Now, you can't possibly do that unless you understand the social structure of the 13th century, let us say, or the 14th century. You understand the relationship between the peasants and what is happening in bastard feudalism, and the relationship with their lords and the intervening yeoman farmers. Then you have to have some understanding of how far they have got in dealing with basic medical problems. You have to understand the nature of a pastoral economy in a series of villages which aren't communicating with each other at all, and all sorts of things, and how information gets around, how people are told things, how many people can read and write, is that important, all the rest of it. You have to have, what I'm trying to say to you, is that you have to have an understanding of the wider political context, not suddenly plunge children into and show them a few pictures and say, look, this is medieval village, think about it. You have to give them a basis of knowledge. You have to give them a knowledge of how history has flown from one period to another and what consequences that has, and how whole thought modes and attitudes are entirely different because of the social circumstances, the political circumstances of the time.
But you wouldn't argue there's no place for imaginative work in history?
Oh, no, 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 absolutely not. I was taught by a great historian, P.D. Whiting, who taught me at my school, and he is a charismatic figure. And back in the 1940s, when I was at school, he was one of the first to take us out all on Saturday afternoons to go and visit ruined castles. I remember going to Porchester. I remember going to see the old Saxon church in Essex on another, the first Saxon church in England, in Essex. And this was quite adventurous in those days. It's much more common now, but this is almost unheard of, you know. The thing you wished to go to was to go and visit the town hall, possibly. That was about it. But he really was imaginative. And during the long holidays, he gave us projects to do. I remember one project, one summer holiday, we were grouped into teams of four, the whole history class, and we were told to take a monument in London, whichever monument we liked, and write its history, and do pictures of it, and describe what was happening in it and the history of the people involved, and present it as a document at the end of the holidays. Now again, that's quite common now. These are projects. In the 1940s, it was not very usual to do anything quite like that. I'll give you a particular example away from history. I remember when I was in my primary school, which is up in Southport, science, going out for a walk and cutting the pussy willow and then drawing it was about it. So things were moving on. So I'm not against imagination history. I think one of the great qualities of the great historians is imagination. If you read Macaulay, his powers of imagination were immense. He could actually make parts of London and parts of history come alive. His essays, his great essays on Pitt and on Clive and on Warren Hastings, absolutely superb imaginative creations.
So it's the superficial approach that you're objecting to?
Yes, really am, absolutely. And I think it's got to be based on knowledge. You can't have historical imagination without knowledge. You've got to have the knowledge of the period and the flow of events.
I ought to ask you, actually, the new history doesn't seem to object to knowledge. It sort of wants children to get knowledge from original sources as opposed to secondary texts.
Yes, I think that is indeed welcome. And I think they're no longer published. There were, about 20 or 30 years ago, very good packages, like this is the gunpowder plot, and it was a folder, and in the gunpowder plot was a reproduction of the letter of Catesby and the picture of the plotters and the journal torn from the House of Commons and all the rest of it. Very interesting stuff. And you did see them. They were presented to you. Because, after all, young students, they were really directed, I think, to sort of 12 to 15-year-olds, that sort of age, could not be expected to go and find Catesby's letter. But it was presented to them, and they then realised the significance of this, and they could measure it. And they'd find it interesting, because it would be in different handwriting, and different words. I'm all in favour of them trying to source, and indeed, my granddaughters, who are state primary school, questioned my wife and I intimately about our experience of the Second World War and what it was like to be taken down in the Blitz to a shelter and all the rest of it, and what rationing was like and what life was like during the war. Yes, so I'm not against that. Absolutely not against it.
So what were you expecting of the History Working Group set up to produce the national curriculum?
I wanted to see essentially a timeline from wherever you started, whether it was pre-Roman Britain or Roman Britain, up to today. So you can see the flow of events and the flow of our history, and to give children an idea of the continuum of history. That is very important, I think. To see where they fit into it all, because we are all creatures of the past in one way or another. We all carry bits of the past stuck on us, like little badges everywhere, affecting us in one way or another. And I thought that was essential to have the understanding.
And was that all you expected to produce?
No, I wanted that to be the basis of it. And then obviously I wanted certain areas looked at more closely and identified, and not just the 20th century. The 20th century is of course very important and relevant to many young people, and they want to know, you know, the rise of communism, the rise of fascism and all the rest of it, and the Second World War and the First World War. All that is really very important. But I wanted also to alert them to the fact of the earlier history. You know, Britain fighting alone in 1940 was very much like 1803. In fact, the danger of 1803 of an invasion was rather more acute than the invasion in 1940. And, you know, as it were, I'm sure that conditioned some of the thinking of Churchill himself. Churchill was a great historian and had a great instinctive feel of what you can pull out of the past to make the present more relevant and important.
Were you surprised they found it difficult to specify the stage of progression and attainment in history?
Yes. I commissioned Saunders Watson, who was head of the Historic House Association and lived in the castle himself, Rockingham. And I was a bit surprised. I was then moved on to another job. I didn't really implement the history curriculum, but I did see the first drafts of it. And I would have hoped they would have been more precise and definite. I think it is possible to define stages of progress and understanding. I'm not saying that you should know every date, I'm not suggesting that at all, but some understanding of what has happened and what happened next, and you could measure what they know. And also to focus on certain key periods. And if you're looking at English history, the 17th century is a key period. Because this is where nearly all our political rights and institutions have emerged from. And I'm rather sad that that gets rather less attention in schools now. There's a lot of attention on the Tudors. Everybody knows about Henry VIII. My grandchildren know the rhyme. They've seen films about it. Everybody knows about Henry VIII. And Starkey has done a wonderful job on Henry VIII. There's no question about that. But I'd like to see a bit more focus now on the 17th century, on the Civil War, on Cromwell and Charles in 1688, because they are so pertinent and relevant to the rights of citizens today, all of that period. And when democracy is under challenge and threat, as it is in many ways, and weakened, it's very important to go back to the birth pangs of democracy in our own country. There was a very good exhibition recently at the British Library on that, which is, I think, the inspiration of Linda Colley on liberties. And I thought that took the story very well through with original documents, right up to today. And it's in the suffragettes and everything. And one of the greatest sadnesses I have now is that the 18th century has almost disappeared below recognition level. If you do the Tudors, then you might just touch quickly on Cromwell and Charles. You'll go straight to Victorian England and then to the 20th century. Which is more immediate, obviously. But the 18th century is, I think, one of the most important periods, and you can see I'm sitting in front of books I've written about the 18th century, Life of George IV in caricature. I've actually produced several books on caricature because I think caricature is a way that you can teach history. Because before the camera came in the middle of the 19th century, the only way that people really recognised their kings and queens and leaders and politicians and rascals and generals were through the caricature prints. They were put up in shop windows. And so they were the paparazzi of the day. And so what I've tried to do in my history books and cartoons is to tell a history. I did the Prime Minister, the history of Prime Ministers in cartoons, history of kings and queens in cartoons, and George IV and George III. I've just done George Washington's War, which is the War of Independence, which is not touched upon in our history curriculum at all, as far as I can see today. But it was an important war, very similar to Afghanistan, by the way. The British generals always asked for more soldiers. If only they could win more soldiers, they would win. They won all the set battles. When they moved on, they lost the land. Certain parallels. But I've enjoyed doing this, but I've also tried to make history more viewable and interesting. And that's very important. And why I regret the 18th century disappearing, I would argue that the period 1780 to 1830 was the period on which we had the greatest influence upon the world in our history. Those 50 years saw the Industrial Revolution, which changed the history of the world. It saw the creation of the British Empire, India, Canada, the West Indies, and Australasia, America rowing away. It was the period of certainly of our greatest poets, Wordsworth, Coleridge, Keats, Shelley, our greatest painters, a whole lot, again, that period. Gainsborough, Stubbs, Lawrence, Turner, Constable. It was seen our greatest soldier and our greatest sailor, Napoleon and fighting Napoleon, Nelson, Wellington. And it saw the beginning of the change of parliamentary reform. It's an immensely important and exciting period. And and all that has had a bigger influence upon the world than any other period in our history. It's hardly touched upon in the curriculum today, and that's a matter of regret to me. So I've tried to make history more interesting and relevant.
It's interesting to speculate on why, I mean, you've convinced me that's an important period, but on why the general public and if you like, schools as well, are more interested in the Tudors, which is a period of religious division, than in the 18th century, which is characterised by European rationalism.
I think the British public liked to see tableaus, and the tableaus of the Tudors, but they loved Jane Austen, and Jane Austen is the end of the 18th century. I always think it's extraordinary, the Sense of Sensibility, the Emma, and Pride and Prejudice. When you read those, you don't realise that Britain is fighting for its life. fighting for his life against Napoleon, who's going to conquer us and the whole of Europe. It's and so they like all that. They like coaches and crinolines and all the rest of it. But it's a very important period that has fundamentally affected us all. It's the period in which the English language spread around the world.
When the National Curriculum for History was first produced, were you aware of any of these important themes being predominant in it, or was it simply an attempt to cover as much that would please everybody?
I think it was a bit of that, quite frankly. I think that it anchored too much in the 20th century, and while it's important to study 20th century history, it can be done largely done on videos. You can see the Second World War on video, you can see the rise of communism on video, you can see the... and they're very vivid, I'm not saying they're not. And there have been wonderful series on the First World War on it. And that can lead you to an understanding of the flow of events. And then those who want to go into it more deeply have to say, well, what is behind this flow of events? Why did it all happen? What were the consequences of it? And things of that sort. You must, and so all I'm trying to do is to try to bring into the understanding of young people today some of the events in the past.
I wonder if you did feel that there ought to be more of a stress on political history, because they introduced these political, economic, social and cultural themes.
Well, I think that it's very difficult to understand our position as a country without understanding the politics of it, and the politics stem from our history. And I think the history of how we've gained our liberties and freedoms is an essential part of our country. One of the reasons why we're so many people want to come to live in our country is because of the rights that were fought in the 16th, 17th and 18th century. The rights of opposition, the right not to be arrested in the middle of the night, the right for fair and open trial, all these things going, in fact, some going back to Magna Carta. And I think children should be aware of that, because there's always a tendency to rough ride over rights for certain reasons, whatever it may be. The right of arbitrary arrest, for example, the right of detention without trial, are very important rights in our history. And freedom of speech, very important freedom, but one that has to be tempered to some extent in a certain way. And I'm talking on the very day when the leader of the British National Party is appearing on Question Time, giving enormous coverage. And the great issue is, should he be allowed to speak or not? It's a very interesting debate.
I'm going to ask you about citizenship later on, but it just seems a convenient point to ask you about that, because you're stressing very much the contemporary relevance of studying political history. Now,
well,
we now have a new subject of citizenship in the curriculum.
Yes.
What's your view about that?
Well, I think this is where quite a lot of the stuff I've been talking about should be centred. But it's not just going along to the town hall and seeing the mayor, and he says, look, this is my train, and look at it, and all the rest of it. I remember doing that as a boy in Southport. And then explaining how committees work at local government. That's all quite interesting in itself. And it's quite important to explain to children the role of local government and what they have to do and the responsibilities they have. You know, clean streets and all the rest of it, and housing and all those sorts of things, very important. But I think citizenship is much more broader than that. You want to try and involve the youngsters to know, you know, voting is important, for example. And I always said to people when I was canvassing as a politician, oh, I'm not going to vote. I said, well, if you don't vote, you lose your right to complain. If you don't vote, that's your choice. It's a free nation, you can do what you want. But don't complain. By voting, you participate and try and make things better. They may or may not things better. You might be let down by the politician, but you're fed up with the politicians. The politicians exact to arbitrate between the desires of people to do things and the necessary constraint on money to do that sort of thing, and they have to balance the rights of different groups of people, the rights of farmers to farm and the rights of walkers to walk over their farms and all these sorts of things, very interesting issues.
So,
and all that is comes within citizenship, but by that I don't want to lose the flow of history. I just want to try and make history more interesting and exciting to people.
That's partly then about training teachers to be engaged with it.
Yes, I agree with that. And I think one of the problems generally of teaching today, I think my generation, certainly at a secondary level, probably were taught by teachers who had read their specialism as a university subject. they'd read history or physics or chemistry or geography or English. That is much less common today, where teachers will have taken a teaching degree with a specialism in within it itself, and necessarily they won't be so absorbed so deeply as someone who had to study history by itself and then becomes a teacher.
That would be at primary level predominantly.
I think at secondary level, I think that at primary level, I think it's a bit easier to do. I think it's more general, and you don't have to have the depth of knowledge for a teacher, primary knowledge, but a primary teacher has to, in my view, has to know about a lot of things in a rather more general way. At a secondary level, you're expecting specialisms of some intensity, particularly if you're growing up beyond 16. And so you do need, and it's quite interesting, another subject, my school, which I went to for 4 years. I was in the state system for 14, then I went to St Paul's. The teachers in St Paul's on Saturday mornings now go to the local state schools to help teaching the sixth forms in subjects which, like maths and physics, where there might be difficulties in getting specialist teachers to do it. And I think that's a very helpful thing indeed. I don't think it's the same to history yet.
No, no. I think there is quite a high level of subject expertise in history,
yes.
So it's reported anyway.
Yes.
In the turbulent years, you record 5 objectives of the national curriculum, which you announced in January 1987. The first was that it should set a standard of knowledge. And I've already mentioned knowledge, but
yes.
Did you think at the time that the History Working Group, when they completed their final report, had fulfilled that objective?
I think to some extent. I think those working groups, I had much more trouble with English than with history. I had to set up 2 groups. I first set up a group of what were considered to be, I suppose in political terms, rather on the right wing, very tough, back to grammar, back to spelling, back to punctuation. They came up with a report which didn't go back to spelling, punctuation and grammar. These are the authors of the black paper. And so I had to set up another group to have a look at it, to introduce some degree of rigour. History was bound to be a developing subject in the national curriculum. There's no question about that at all. But I was much more... I wanted to see a greater emphasis on knowledge rather than the process of learning. Now, I do appreciate how important the process of learning is, but I think the absolute absorption of knowledge, which king followed which king and queen and what happened, is very, very important. And the task for a history teacher is to somehow make that interesting. Now, today, they have wonderful books. Some of the books produced in early history, absolutely wonderful. I was up in York Minster at the weekend going around York. I went to the wonderful museum, the Castle Museum in York, and I bought instantly for my 10 or 12 year old grandchildren some of their books on Tudor, Stuarts and 18th century, and they're very, very good these days, and they do the whole story. It's just not politics. They do the Industrial Revolution, and they do what it was like to live and how to travel in those days and all. And I thought they were A, very well drawn, interesting, and so I bought several.
You seem to be quite optimistic about the way the national curriculum has worked out then.
I think that standards today in schools are better than they were. I think that the national curriculum was necessary and will survive. I think it has to be modified in certain ways, I've suggested. I think at 14, I think there is a break point. And I think that some youngsters will want to follow more practical, skill-based education. And I'm setting up colleges to do that now, with the support of the government and of the opposition as well.
What is your view about the flexibility that's been allowed in the History National Curriculum in recent years?
I was very sad that one of my successors, I think it was Ken Clark, abandoned history up to 16. The only other country in Europe that allows this is Albania. Other countries insist upon history going on until 16. And because history is so much part of their national identity. France, for example.
Yes, I'm sure it's very original. I think we were talking about the sort of flexibility that's now allowed in the curriculum.
Yes. I think that if it helps the teachers, I'm not against that. But I would still hope they all realise that it's a story. with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and a continuum. And I hope that they will not abandon that particular aspect of it.
You've proposed a Museum of British History be established. Mm. Why do you think such an institution is needed?
Because of all the problems we've been talking about. History, I think, is under pressure in schools. Some schools give it up altogether at 14 now, which is a sadness, I think, because they're not enough interested by the pupils, or they might have to get special teachers in to do it and that sort of thing. And so I think one of the ways of capturing the imagination of children and also getting their understanding would be for them to go through a museum that tells the whole history of our country from Roman times till today, and to see in its richness, just not the political history, how people lived in the Middle Ages, how people moved around the country in the 18th century, how people were heated and lighted in the 19th century. It's all very interesting, and that could all be incorporated in a very simple way in it. I remember as a boy going to the Science Museum back in the 1940s. In the basement they had six big tableaus of lighting through the ages. You pressed a button, and first you were with a caveman with a little sort of flickering, and then you went up through it all. And that stuck in my mind. That's still with me. I can still see the pictures, right? So I believe very much in visual impression, and I would like to see a museum. It'd have to be in central London. And Gordon Brown agrees with me, but we haven't actually brought it about. A museum that would actually tell the whole history, which every pupil in the country, I mean the whole country, would go to twice while they're at school, both as primary and secondary. And they would go through, and it'd be a big day out for them to see, to remember, and they would see history. They would see the story of our country. And I think that would be very exciting for them. You see, there's no museum. There's museums that tell to do certain things. There's a science museum which does science very well. There's the Natural History Museum which does history very well. There's not a museum that tells the political history of our country anywhere. Not one. The National Portrait Gallery gets closest to it, and those are portraits, which are magnificent and wonderful to people who know about history. But someone doesn't know about history? Well, who's that funny wig? Who's that? Why would Walpole never heard of him? What would he do? What did he do? What was that severe man? Gladstone, I've seen the name. What did he do? No, you've got to bring it alive. And I would like to see in this museum all that I've talked about, the social life and the political life and everything. But I'd like to see the debates created between, and they can be done very easily, between Pitt and Fox in a very imaginative way. The debates between Gladstone and Disraeli on empire and war. The debates between Nyren Bevan and Ian MacLeod on the future of the health service, the creation of the health service. The debates between Margaret Thatcher and Neil Kinnock. The debates between Blair over the Iraq War. Brought to life, made interesting, made relevant, so they come to have a view of them.
Accepting that museums are a great thing for children, and schools like to take children out for trips because they do stick in the memory. Couldn't one argue that there is a tremendous amount of wonderful visual and stimulating material available both in school and out of school today? That in a sense, it's
marvelous.
Problem with history isn't so much a lack of materials or places to visit. That it's the point that you were making about schools.
Look, suppose you go to the Army Museum in London, which is a nice little modest museum. That's just the Army. Then you go after Greenwich to see the Navy Museum. Bring together the involvement of the Army and the Navy, the importance of the Army in the extension of empire, the importance of the Navy in the creation of empire, for example. The importance of sea power and shipping for the wealth of the country of Victorian England. And what was else happening in Victorian England at the time? Bring it sort of in a coordinated way. And it's marvellous to go and see Drake's Drum, which somewhere down at Plymouth, I think, isn't it? Marvellous, but I'd like to see the Armada fitted into, you know, what was happening else in that time and all the rest of it. And were we top dog? No, we weren't. We were going to be defeated, and Elizabeth going to Tilbury and all the rest of it. I knew with Plymouth when you went to Tilbury. Bring it more together. And I feel this quite passionately, actually. And I would like to see that. because I think it's so exciting. I just love history, you see, so I find it so exciting. And I do like going to all these. I helped to maintain and fund the Cartoon Museum. Now, we started this 3 years ago, and it tells the history of cartooning from... And graphic satire is one of the arts we created in Britain. We haven't created many arts. Can you think of many? Choral singing might be one, brass bands might be another. But graphic satire was one of the arts we actually created in Britain in the middle of the 18th century. And we tell the whole history, but we also do the history of comics. We do the whole history of comics from the 19th century to today. And we have masses of school visits. And it's now the most successful small museum in the country, 100 yards of visual museum. It's only 4,000 square feet, over 30,000 visitors a year. And we now have an education officer who brings children, they love it. And we do give them a bit of history when they come. This is what happened.
To what extent could or should concerns about national identity or ethnic and social diversity affect the history taught in schools?
Say that again, sorry.
To what extent should concerns about national identity or ethnic and social diversity affect history?
Well, this is where the museum would help enormously, because one of the things you would realise in going around this museum, that we are a polyglot nation, that we've always been a mixture, Vikings, Danes, Picts, Celts, Romans, people from all over made us what we are, the Anglo-Saxons dominated really from Central Europe. Northern Central Europe. And then during the centuries, the Huguenots coming in. During the 19th century, the Jewish refugees from every country in the world. And until the great surge in economic migrants, economic refugees, we always took in, if you look at the figures, up until 1980, 5,000 people a year who were refugees.
Do you think within...
Who were political refugees, people about to be killed or tortured or raped or murdered.
Mm.
And it's remarkably regular, 5,000 a year, for a long period since 1985. And before that, we had surges, of course. In the Nazi years, we had a surge. And in the Russian years, we've had a surge. And as a result, we are now very much a multi-nation country. There are large groups of people who come from places like Ethiopia and Somalia, which I don't think I learned anything about at school at all, except I read Prester John. But just sat there, but and they have come here because they like our country, because it's developed in a particular way from our history. And inclusion is would be a very big message of any museum of British history.
But it should also be within the curriculum in the schools that teachers teach.
Yes, I think it's part of history. I think it's actually part of our history to show how we have all come together from different backgrounds and different races, different creeds, different colours, everything.
One of the issues that teachers often raise is that they agree with all that, but they're not given the time to do it in school.
Well, that comes back to my great regret, another teaching period.
Perhaps that's where we need to...
I went to a training college last week in Basildon, where they're taking 14-year-olds for one day a week in bricklaying and plastering and the building trades. They have to turn up at 8:30 in the morning. If they don't, they can't continue their studies. They're always turn up at 8:30. And at 4:30, they want to go on longer. If the interest is there, the student will stay.
That's
and learn. That's the challenge of the teacher.